This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 203, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Irina Scott about her book, Pascagoula, The Ultimate Close UFO Encounter, Best Documented Nuclear Government and Mind Control Dimensions. Irina is the author of several books on UFOs. She served on the MUFON Board of Directors and is a MUFON consultant in physiology and astronomy, as well as a field investigator. As the MUFON Director of Publications, she co-edited 8 symposium proceedings. The Defense Intelligence Agency employed Irina in PhD-level research in satellite photography, including its Air Order of Battle section. Hi, Irina. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We're going to talk about your book. It's called Pascagoula, The Ultimate Close UFO Encounter, Best Documented Nuclear, Government and Mind Control Dimensions. I wanted to ask you about your experiences first. So could you tell us what happened when you were driving with your sister? You just left Boston, I think.
I was working for the Defense Intelligence Agency at the time, and I had a real high security clearance. So it was kind of like you might call even a military type sighting in a way. My sister was at Drew University taking postgraduate work, and we were from someplace else, but we were both on the East Coast. She was working in New Jersey by New York, and I was working in Washington, D.C. And so we decided to go up along the coast and see the New England states. And we had planned to stay at Boston, but we got there a little bit early, and we went on up Route 3. And actually, I found out later, we kind of in some of the area where the Hill abduction had happened, very end of it. And so anyway, we returned to Boston. We were looking for hotel rooms or motel rooms and didn't find any. And so we were going around the outer belt and look, and we were heading out of Boston. And there was an airport south of us, the Norwood Memorial Airport. And we could see airplanes coming in and turning on their landing lights. And we could see their red and green wing lights and everything, and landing lights and strobe lights and all that. And we were kind of watching them too. But we saw something lower than the airplanes, and it was blinking, but it didn't look like an airplane. It was just one white light, and it was blinking. And so we kept looking at that too. After a while, my sister said it might be a UFO. It's something you don't talk about, but we both admitted to each other that we'd seen UFOs before. And so we were driving along and we kept seeing it. And she has real good eyesight, really good eyesight. And I was driving, not paying attention to it. And so she kept saying, "This is weird." And I kept saying, "Oh, it's a helicopter," and telling her she was crazy. So we were driving along and we got on Route 9 going south, 95 going south, which is the main freeway along the coast. And there was a woods on the west-hand side of the road. And I looked in the woods as I was driving by, and there was this sort of like a glass globe, and inside of it was some type of thing that was changing colors in a spectrum, and I think it was red and blue and different shades of red and blue and purple and so on. It seems to be changing colors, and there seemed to be a thin thing on the outside that was very slowly going around it, like a C-shaped thing on a globe. I couldn't imagine what it was, and then the inside of the car turned green, and it stayed green for a little while. And I couldn't figure out what on earth was going on. I didn't know much about UFOs at the time. And then finally it went off and we continued. And after a while, my sister started screaming at me to stop and pull over. And I told her she was crazy again. But I stopped and pulled over, and then it was to the east of us then. And I didn't really see it. I looked and I saw what looked like a meteor way off in the distance. And I started to point at it. And I was going to say to my sister, you know, that's nothing. That's a helicopter or whatever. And then this big thing came over the trees right where I saw the meteor. And at that time, I realized my sister was right and I was wrong. And I wasn't aware of it, but when we both wrote up our reports, she said that when we first saw it, when we pulled over and saw it, that it shined a light in the car. And that the light was sort of a strange looking thing. I think maybe blue or purple or something. And I wasn't aware of that, but I think it happened about the same time I saw the meteor. But I was in the car facing it with the window, and she was on the inside of the car. So if the inside of the car lit up, she would have seen it and I wouldn't have. And so anyway, the thing came over the road very slowly and very low. It was so low we could see details, and there seemed to be at that time like seven windows, and they were big windows, and they had square corners, unlike an aircraft. It made no sound at all. It was just sort of levitating along, and the windows took up a big part of its size, and we both said we discussed it, and both, you know, we said, how many windows do you see? Do you hear it? Things like that. And we also discussed whether they were windows or panels, because sometimes blimps have panels, and we both thought they were windows. And I've seen a lot of blimps with lighted sides, and I even have videos of them on YouTube. And I never saw anything even close to being like that. Plus, it didn't make any sound. And we didn't see an undercarriage or anything like that. It was just a big thing and with seven windows. So anyway, I was working for the DIA and I was in photography. And I also had back in those days, we different cameras than now, but I had a Polaroid camera, and I also had Polaroid film with high speed so that I could take nighttime photographs. This was at night. So it was dark and everything. So anyway, I found my scurrying around quickly while it was there. I found my camera and dug out the film and was loading the camera. And I thought I could just get an amazing picture, because I could get this thing with the windows, and I could get the freeway, and I could get it hanging over the freeway and that sort of thing. And I thought, I'll prove UFOs exist. Plus, the light was coming from the inside of it. And so a truck pulled over right in front of us and stopped at that time when I thought I was going to get the world's best picture. And the truck driver came up and stood beside me and asked what we were doing. And this seemed like a really weird question, because this thing was up there in the sky. And so I pointed at it like it was an airplane and like it was from the airport or something, and just pointed at it and said we were looking at that. Well, he just rotated around, looking exactly the opposite direction. He must have known where it was, because he looked in the exact opposite and said, I don't see anything. And then he turned back around to me. And at that time, I realized, I thought it was great, because I was going to get another witness. And then I realized that I wasn't going to get another witness, because he was just off. And he should have been a real good witness. I mean, he was standing there looking at it. And so anyway, then he asked me the exact same question again. What are you doing? Like, nothing was going on. And so again, I pointed at it. I didn't say UFO or anything. He turned around again the opposite direction and said, I don't see anything. Then he turned around to me and gave me a sign or signal, which I interpreted as him telling me I was crazy. I don't know. I don't remember exactly. I think he pointed to his head or something, whatever, and went back to his truck. Well, at that time, the thing had a pattern blinking, and I don't remember exactly what it was. We saw seven big windows, and it was like the first three windows would blink on and off and on and off, and then all seven, and then the last four, and then go back through the cycle again. It was something like that. And it had a very small, non-blinking red light on one end and green light on the other. We don't remember which end each other was at, but it slowly went over the road. And at that time, I had just missed what I thought was the best photograph you could ever take of a UFO. And I was on the freeway and I had high speed film. And so I thought there was a hill beside us, and I thought I'd run up the hill. And my sister tried to stop me, and I kept saying, you have to guard the car. And she didn't know what I meant at the time. And I many, many years later, I found out why she said that, and that's because she didn't know the man was there for some reason. But anyway, I ran up the hill, and I got five pictures, and one of them turned out. And then I came down, and the thing went to the airport and began to circle. And we noticed that none of the airplanes were landing when it was circling the airport. If today you'd be check on things like that because you'd have internet and things like that, but back then there was nothing we could do. But anyway, it started circling the airport, and it had a pattern of when it would go from south to north in a half circle and blink its lights on twice. Then going north to south, it would be so fast you couldn't even see it. It was just amazing speed. And my sister had said that all along, that what made her think it was odd was because it would just be one place and then it'd be another. And I didn't notice that at the time, but she did. And so anyway, at that time, it had been coming down the freeway ahead of us. We were going south, and it was going south and a little bit ahead of us. But at that time, we thought it was going to head north, and we both wanted to see it and figure out what it was. We couldn't believe it. And I had just missed this wonderful picture, and she was just totally curious about what was inside because she couldn't see anything inside. And so I got on the freeway, and I was going to come to the next intersection and turn around and go back. So I got on the freeway. The truck driver pulled out and got just right on my bumper. And at first I thought he must be trying to pass or something. I changed lanes and slowed down, sped up, not everything like that. And he just kept on following me, right on my bumper. And he was shining his headlights into my car, his bright headlights. And I couldn't see because of the light reflecting from the mirror. And I thought we were going to die. And I switched lanes, and finally I just sped up as fast as I could go because he was in a truck, and I thought the truck wouldn't go that fast, but it did. And so we missed several intersections, but then I decided that to get rid of him, that on the left-hand side of the road, I would go to the next intersection and right at the last second swerve off on the intersection so that he wouldn't have time to think about it and do the same thing. And that was very dangerous because somebody's coming faster on the right-hand side, we would have a big crash and probably get killed or something. And so I did. And so far as I know, I got rid of him. And we went back, and then it stopped circling the airport and it started going northwest. And the roads more or less went north and south and east and west, so I had to zigzag to follow it. And finally, I was on this real bad, horrible country road with potholes and everything and gravel and houses miles away from each other where you couldn't even see the next house and no place to turn around. And I was following it, and it was going slowly and ahead of us and blinking. But I couldn't keep up with it, and I wasn't getting a good pic. I couldn't get a picture, and it was tearing up my car. I had to turn around, and we went back to Drew University, where she was staying. I had taken two coworkers with me when I left Washington, D.C., and they had left us at Drew University, and I'd taken pictures of all of them by my sister's dorm, and they wanted to ride back. And so we went back to my sister's dorm, and the first thing we did was call our parents and tell them what happened. And then we told her roommates, who didn't believe us. And then I had to wait for these coworkers, and they never showed up. And I left real late. And back then you didn't have cell phones. And if we left the room, we asked our roommates to let us know if they called, and they never contacted me. And when I got back to work later, they were really mad at me and said they had to take a taxi back, and they didn't know why they couldn't. And this was very funny because they knew where I was because I'd even taken a picture of them. But anyway, I waited until later. And that evening, I started back to Washington, D.C. and got back there. And later that night, I had a poltergeist experience that lasted most of the night. But I got up the next morning and went to work. And that night, I wrote everything up. And it turned out years later, we discovered that my sister had also written everything up on a letter to my mother on the same day it happened. So we had two write-ups that we both made immediately afterwards. And later, the picture I got was confusing, but I had some help to understand it. And finally, I did. And I published that in a scientific journal, in the journal, the AAAS science journal, and said that for photographic reasons, I thought there was a light on it that wasn't in the visible range. And so anyway, that's what happened to us. It was pretty spooky.
Did you find out that there may have been some missing time?
There may have been missing time, because later I reported it, and Bud Hopkins had asked me for a timetable, and I couldn't give it to him because I had written everything up, but for some reason I hadn't put the time, any times on at all. Maybe it was because I'd forgotten my watch. But then just a couple of years ago, my sister found her letter to my mother, and she had times written down. And yes, we thought, there was probably missing time, because we thought we saw the thing at about 10:30 after we got back to Boston. And we thought we saw it for about an hour. And the time from Boston to New York, especially in the middle of the night when there's less traffic, would be about 3 hours. And so we got back at 6 o'clock in the morning. And from that, I could calculate, I thought we had missing time. It was too late to tell Bud Hopkins because he was dead by that time. But I think there was missing time.
It's a really good experience, isn't it? A very close-up sighting of a UFO, and quite extended as well compared to a lot of sightings.
Yeah, we chased it, and I mean, it was in view for at least an hour and did all kinds of acrobatics while we were watching it too.
And it's interesting how the truck driver behaved as well. I wonder if he was under the influence of, you know, the ETs in some way, something telepathic, or maybe he was a screen memory.
Well, for most of the time until my sister found her letter and I asked her, I thought that too, that maybe he was a MIB or had been influenced by the UFO. But then when my sister found her letter, she mentioned nothing about the man. And so I asked her, and she said she didn't know he was there, which was funny. I mean, maybe she was just concentrating so hard that she didn't notice or something. But after that, I began to wonder if he was a screen memory or something, because one of us didn't know he was there, apparently. And I didn't realize that until then. I always thought we both saw him. And I should have realized it earlier, because when I ran up the hill, my sister tried to keep me from running up the hill. And I kept saying, you have to guard the car. And she didn't know what I was talking about. And so I figured out why after that. But I didn't realize that until just a couple of years ago, until she found her letter, that she didn't seem to know he was there. I mean, she saw him chase us in the truck when we were on the freeway and knew about that, but she didn't know I was talking to him. It seemed to just be blanked out of her mind.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? That's what happens, though, isn't it, with these sorts of encounters? Some of this is almost typical with this strangeness.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people have the same experience and remember it differently. And a lot of people don't remember it. And sometimes, you know, two people see something and one will remember it and another person won't. And, you know, it's very irritating to the person that remembers it that the other one says, oh, nothing happened. Because it ruins your credibility. I'm sure glad my sister remembered it.
The book's about Pascagoula. And is this something where a lot of new information has come up and that's what's in the book?
Yes. I found out several new things. One of them, the main thing I realized is that it's an abduction and it was two people on a pier. And they got abducted, and they were just two regular, normal people that had no interest in UFOs at all. They were just going out fishing, and they got abducted. And usually abductions are in places, secluded places with no other witnesses. And somebody will say, well, I was abducted, but they don't have any other way to document it. And so nobody believes them. And abduction in general in ufology isn't even accepted because there's no documentation. Well, this was different because there were a whole lot of, it turned out there were a whole lot of people that saw the object. And there was even another couple that reported an abduction about the same time and place. And so this was really, really strange for an abduction because it just flew in the face of all the other tales of abduction. And we just wrote the books about it, that there were so many witnesses, and there were a lot because the sheriff's office, right when it happened, it had about over 50 calls from people saying, this is weird. And then we had found a lot of more witnesses when we began to investigate. So there's maybe 100 witnesses that it's something very strange was flying around. And that's just totally different from an abduction where there's no other witnesses. But after a number of years of working on it, I realized that this was by a nuclear site. And so this wasn't just a standard abduction. This was actually, I think it should be reclassified and considered nuclear site sighting.
Because you say that the abduction took place close to what some would say is the Navy's Area 51.
Yes. Nobody seemed to realize that. And usually with nuclear sites, there's standard nuclear sites that are related to UFOs. And these are like nuclear missile sites where somebody sees a UFO over a missile, and sometimes things are changed about the missile or its programming, or they're cut off and that sort of thing. And or nuclear sites like Hanover or Oak Ridge or things like that. There are no nuclear sites. Well, and back in those days, they didn't advertise nuclear sites. I mean, like the Manhattan Project was totally secret, and there's nuclear sites around, but nobody said anything. Well, this was by a shipbuilding site, and you wouldn't think of that as nuclear. And so nobody paid attention to that. But due to some reasons, I finally did. And they were the company that they were right beside was building nuclear submarines and some of them with nuclear missiles. And another branch was building nuclear submarines with big, like ballistic type missiles on them. So this was a definite nuclear site. Not only that, but it was a nuclear missile site too. So it was like Area 51. I mean, Area 51, they're making a big deal. You know, they're making, well, they claim that they're making UFOs and things, but they're making new aircraft, and it was very secret.
Yeah.
But this was like that too, and nobody realized it.
So the story was that, is it Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson were fishing, and they were picked up by some ETs of some type and taken on board a UFO.
Yes.
And there was a thing, I think Calvin Parker said that he couldn't remember what happened because he'd passed out, but you found out that wasn't true?
Charles was older. I think he was about 45. Calvin was just a young teenager, 18 or 19, and Charles had military and had been in life and death situations, and he thought he could talk about that sort of thing, and he could hold up to all the harassment, you know, after being, you know, almost shot in the military and everything. Well, Calvin was a young teenager, and he had his whole life ahead of him, and he didn't want to go through life with everybody making fun of him. And so he just said, well, he passed out, and that way he didn't have to say anything about it. But 50 years later, he decided to talk about it, and he said he didn't pass out, that he remembered it, but he just didn't want, you know, to be harassed his whole life. So he remembered it too.
And it's fascinating what he says happened to him. It gets really quite weird, I think. But he had an encounter with an alien that he said was female.
Yeah, like I said, they always say people that claim abduction are doing it for the publicity and they want attention and everything. Well, he never talked about it for 50 years, and he definitely didn't want the attention. But when he finally did start talking about it, he didn't talk about that at first, but he talked about what appeared to be a female, like, you know, a human female, but in not quite, so that it was obvious it wasn't a real female, that sort of inspected him and talked to him and gave him prophecies and different things like that.
And didn't he say that thought that this alien was going to kill him? Was it that they cut his hand and the blood was coming out of his hand?
Yes. And he remembered also in several places he said he thought he had died and come to life. And he also talked about having his blood drained out and something else put in and that sort of thing.
The aliens that came out of the craft and took them into it, they're unlike any other descriptions I've heard anywhere else. Have you heard of this description of these weird-looking aliens in any other encounter?
No, and that's something that makes you think that they're honest, is because if you were going to do a hoax, you'd sort of make your describe your aliens as something like somebody else had described. Well, theirs were totally different. I mean, a lot of, like a standard alien, there's not one, but often they're called like the Greys or something, where they're little skinny things with big heads and eyes and everything. Well, these were, they were short, but they were built like football players or the Hillsbury Doman or something, and chunky. They didn't seem to have eyes, and they were like a real bad sketch of a human, because like we have protuberances on our head, like ears and and those, well, they just had little things sticking out, like where we'd have a ears and a nose, like it was just a real bad sketch of a person. It was just real, like they were they were just saying that's close enough for government work or something, and made a model of a human in a way.
And did they think that they were kind of robotic?
Yeah, they thought they were robots. A lot of people seem to think that when they see aliens, that they kind of all look alike. And in these cases, they thought they behaved like robots and not like beings would behave.
Did they say that these abductors that took them that time communicated with them, or that they just took them?
They took them, and the only thing that Charles reported was a big camera, a big thing like an eye, I suppose, like a camera, circled him and like it was scanning him. And Calvin did that too. But Calvin also reported that this female discussed things with him and gave prophecies and things like that.
So what sort of prophecies were there? Because I hear sometimes abductees talk about being shown apocalypse, but was this something else?
Yeah, that's what he was shown. Is he'd say that, like he showed, you know, the flesh melting off people's bones and things like that. Like there was a huge, huge atomic war or something. And she showed him that as part of our future. And then said that we'd survive eventually.
Well, it's worrying, isn't it? But sometimes I think the apocalypse that's shown is more environmental than nuclear.
It could be.
Well, the two of them, Parker and Hickson, went to the police, and I believe there was a sneaky thing the police did with a tape recorder. Is it that they were left alone in a room?
Well, this is what convinced everybody. Calvin didn't want to report it at all, but Charles decided to report it. And this is something totally different, because usually with abductions, if you're out and you get abducted and nobody's around, you don't report it because everybody will call you crazy. And there were two of them, but Calvin didn't want to report it. But Charles, he had been in the military. He thought this is the right thing to do, to report it. And so he tried to report it. And at that time, there was a whole lot of harassment. If anybody even saw UFOs, you'd get made fun of for weeks. And so he tried to report it. And he went to, first of all, a newspaper. And the newspaper was closed. It didn't take, had no interest at all. Then he called the nearest airport. And they said, well, UFOs don't exist. We don't, you know, it was after Blue Book. And so they just said, you know, forget about it. And I think it was after hours too. And they told him to report to the sheriff's office while Calvin was going crazy and not wanting to report at all. But Charles reported it to the sheriff's office, and they brought him in that night, not too long afterwards. And they both remembered things. And so anyway, the sheriff's office split them and interviewed each of them separately. Then they put them in a room together and interviewed them. And then the interviewer walked out. And what they didn't know was that there was a tape recorder in with them. And so they had their private conversation. And the police wanted to find out whether they were hoaxing or not. And they figured if they were in a room by themselves, thinking nobody else was there, and they were hoaxing, they'd be laughing and saying, well, we put one over. Instead, they were both having nervous breakdowns. They were discussing it, which also shows that Calvin remembered things, although he said later he passed out. Well, he remembered being captured and everything else. But they're talk to each other was just that they were terrified and going to pieces about it. And it was real obvious from their from their conversation, and that's still on the internet. People can listen to them and hear the stress in their voice and everything else, that they were definitely not hoaxing. Something really happened to them.
Was there a thing the press, the media seemed to present those two as if they were just a couple of drunks out fishing and that they weren't very educated, but that's not right?
That's the way they've always been presented and criticized. And all that was ever known about it before was that they were, just out, just two good old boys out drinking and all that. Well, that's why I think the thing that I've discovered about the military is important, because people pay really good attention to UFO sightings over nuclear bases and nuclear facilities and missile facilities. And nobody until now had realized that this was a military, nuclear, and missile facility that they were abducted by. And there's a lot of literature, I don't know how well attested, but the UFOs have an interest in things like that, in missiles and nuclear facilities, and this seems to attract them. Well, so there was a reason why they were there, and a reason why so many other people saw them. So I was just saying that after all those years of making fun of them, there's a good reason why the UFOs were there. And it wasn't just that they were drunk and went out and saw UFOs. The UFOs were maybe attracted to the top-level military site.
Yeah, it's something we see often, isn't it? I'd like to get onto the Blairs, because they were in a car on the other side of the river from Calvin Parker and Hixson?
Yes, he was to go out in a ship to supply the offshore, whatever is going on, drilling or whatever. And his supervisor was late. And so they were in a car with a deck outside, and the ship was at the end of the deck. But the other person that was going wasn't there and late. And so they were waiting. And they got there early, and this, of course, was before cell phones and all that. So that Mary began to see something flying up and down around the river, which would be the Pascagoula. And she thought it was an airplane, but the lights were different. And she kept watching it and couldn't figure out what it was, and thought it was about to crash and everything else. And then they decided to walk down the pier to the ship. It was about 9 o'clock, and he was walking ahead of her, and something flopped up in front of her on the pier. And she thought it looked like a person. And she was very, very, very emotional about it when I discussed her sighting with her. And so they walked on to the boat, and then she didn't get back until around 12. And she was terrified, and she ran back down the pier and jumped in her car and left. And so anyway, there was the reason we found out about it was because somebody posted a video on YouTube of Calvin giving a talk, and a woman had written in and said she knew it was true because her parents had seen it. And we contacted her, and that was their daughter who wrote and said her parents had seen it. And she said then, well, they'd never been abducted. But anyway, I kept in contact with Maria, and kept, because of the two strange things, one thing was a thing that jumped up on the pier, And the other thing was there seemed to be a time, missing time or something, because she left 12 and cut back at, I mean, at 9, got back at 12. And so I kept in contact with her for a couple of years. And then her husband had always been a skeptic. He didn't believe in UFOs. He didn't think they existed. He thought she was crazy and all that. Well, unfortunately, he became very ill. And then he was put on a ventilator, and he died not too long afterwards. But right before he went on the ventilator, and you can't talk on when you're on them, he told her that they had been abducted and that he had kept it from her. And he knew something about it, like he'd been in contact with them previously, and that he had asked him not to hurt her and things like that. And so after that, she didn't remember it very clearly, but then she was hit. Philip Mantle had her hypnotized and things. And she said that when she was abducted, that they were interested in her eggs and her DNA, and they wanted to breed hybrids or something of them and us, and be like humans and be on Earth like humans. And she kept saying something about driving cars that I didn't understand. And she said some of them are here now. And she said that under hypnosis. But she under hypnosis, she remembered an abduction, and he seemed to remember it consciously, but he hadn't talked about it. So the abduction happened at they were on the other side of the river, and they had seen the UFO and some of the activity, and they didn't know what was going on. But then that many years later, they realized that was an abduction, and they had been possibly abducted at just about the same time and location. They were just on the other side of the river.
And it's weird that her husband seemed to have some kind of agreement or be working with them. Is that right?
Well, it's unclear, but it's it's what it seemed like to me, that he had some kind of agreement that they wouldn't hurt her, and he seemed to be working with him some way. And I think she was worried about her DNA and her kids on account of that. And so there wasn't much more information because he died. But sometimes they say that humans are working with aliens and things, and I wasn't able to get any more information on that. I wish I could have, but I wasn't.
But it's interesting that they would say something like, or Maria would, because we know that decades later, maybe in the 90s, and it started becoming apparent there was some kind of hybrid program, and abductees would report about it. But she was talking about it maybe like 20 years or so before.
Yeah, I mean, she was hypnotized just a few years ago, but this happened back in 1973. And I don't remember as much about hybrids and anything back then.
Did the Blairs describe the same ETs as Parker and Hixon?
In general, they did. I think one of the things he said was they were, he seemed to report them as being taller, but I don't think it was real clear the way they described them, but I think in general it was kind of like the same. I don't think they went into much detail about their appearance as Charles and Calvin had.
So can we move on then? Because there's so much that happened in that area around that time, because there was an unidentified submerged object, wasn't there? And there were plenty of witnesses for that as well.
There were a good many witnesses, and I talked to the only one that is still alive. And this was investigated by authorities, and they didn't know what it was. The one I talked to was 16 at the time. He and his father were out in a boat, net fishing, and they saw this light, and they couldn't figure out what it was. And the father had his oar, and he was splashing around with it, and he would hit it sometimes, and it would sound like metal. And so their relatives were also out fishing, and they saw the thing, and it would light up, and it'd be close to them, and they would splash around and bother it, and then it'd turn its lights off, and it'd appear someplace else, and I think there were some other boats around that saw it. So nobody could figure out what it was. It was underwater and lit up from underneath. And so he and his father went to the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard, two Coast Guard officers came out with them in their own boat, and also looked at it and poked it and things like that, and said it was really, really strange. And the one Coast Guard man said that one thing strange about it was if you put oars out over the light coming from it, that the light went right through it like an X-ray, and it didn't make a shadow. And the Coast Guard guys couldn't figure it out either. There were 9 witnesses, and including the Coast Guard, there were a lot of witnesses that saw it, and nobody could figure out what it was. And in my book, I drew a contrast between the way Charles and Calvin had been treated. They had been laughed at and harassed and everything you can imagine, so bad that nobody else wanted to report anything. Whereas the underwater object sighting had been taken seriously and investigated by the Navy and the Coast Guard and everything else. And I wondered why there was such a difference, because they were real close in locality. But now I know why. And that's because the Coast Guard knew that there was a nuclear installation there, and nobody else did. So it's probably why the Coast Guard was, and with the Coast Guard and people, the government people were investigating that a lot more seriously than the abduction. But this happened just about a month later, and in about the same place.
And so some naval intelligence officers looked into it as well.
Yes. And some of them knew it was a nuclear site too, but they didn't want the public to know.
And were there other underwater sightings as well in the days or months afterwards?
Yeah, there were. I think it was before that one. Some people had been working on, I think it was a ship, and they were over the water, and a group of objects came up the river and passed them. I think they said they were about the size of a truck or a car or something, and went up the river. And then later, the group went back down, and they, you know, a number of people saw them, and they had no idea what they were. And I think that was a little before this one.
Why do you think that the Blairs and Calvin Parker and Hickson were picked up by the UFO? Do you think they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time?
I don't know. I think it had something, you know, it was just presented as two drunk Southerners out fishing, but they were close to the object. They both had military experience. Charles had been in the Army and things. And also, Calvin said that his father had worked at Area 51. He thought maybe that had something to do with it. But otherwise, it's unknown.
Yeah, it seems like just a coincidence in a way that So, but didn't they say that they saw the UFO and it was like a big blue light and it seemed to be circling and almost like it was searching for something?
That's what Maria described, Maria Blair, at first, that it seemed to be searching for something. And a number of the other witnesses also described that something flying around that looked like gave the appearance of searching for something, but it was just flying around. And she kept saying the pilot must be crazy. What's it doing? And it wasn't really going anywhere. It was just flying around there. But now we know it was a nuclear site that was flying over or near and probably over too.
Yeah, because isn't that site, the company there are the largest producers of Navy ships?
Yes. The company at that time was building nuclear submarines with nuclear missiles. And a branch of it that was at Pascagoula was building those. And then another branch in Virginia, Newport News, has always been building nuclear subs with big, impressive nuclear missiles. And this, I mean, like you don't think of a shipbuilding as nuclear, but actually most of the nuclear force today is actually in submarines. And so the UFOs seem to be updated and knew more about what was going on than humans did.
Pascagoula happened in 73, and that was a big year for sightings, wasn't it? Was it one of the biggest in history?
Well, I have several references in my book where people say this was the largest UFO wave or flap ever. And it was just amazing because at that time, I became aware of it because I was working in Missouri and my mother was in Ohio, about 600 miles away. And one night, I received a phone call from my mother who said she and Dad had heard an explosion. She didn't know what was going on and asked me if I heard it. And I told her she was crazy that I couldn't hear it for 600 miles and things. And it turned, that's how I first got into investigating Pascagoula, was is that there was a huge noise that happened the same time as the abduction. And it was heard over a real wide area of the country, and it was never explained. And so I was kind of in on it because it happened the same time as the abduction. And it was years before I did anything, but I started trying to figure out what the sound was and even wrote a letter in the paper in the scientific literature about it later. But that's how I found out about it, was because at the same time as the abduction, there was this huge noise that was never explained that traveled over area of the United States. But on that same night, there were a lot of other stories about abductions. There were just a huge number of sightings, just sightings flowing in. And later, my mother, who was also skeptic, called me and said that people were acting like it was a war zone, that they were hiding in their basements and not going out at night and things like that. And there were descriptions like that in the literature. Like at one night in Columbus, Ohio, the newspaper reported that there were 150 reports one night, which may have been some kind of record. But there were a huge number of reports like in Pascagoula and other places too.
Well, it's a great book and it's fascinating. It's a very long book. It's great to have so much information. And it's called Pascagoula, The Ultimate Close Encounter, Best Documented Nuclear Government and Mind Control Dimensions. And can you tell us about your other books?
My other books have been, I've had five of them published by Phoenix Press, which is a wonderful press. And my first one is UFOs Today, and it was just a general outline of, I put it in a chronological order of UFO sightings. My next one was I had worked, Wright-Patterson is in Ohio, and I had worked at Battelle Memorial Institute, and they had done a study, a top secret study of Project Blue Book. And I knew people that were involved in that. And also I'd been at Wright-Patterson and been in the really secured area and that type of thing. And so I had notes from several people that worked at the at Battelle at the time of the top secret study and things. And that's what the material I used, the material from people that knew about the study and my own observations and photography of the secured area of Wright-Patterson. I'd also written about Pascagoula. I gave some emphasis to the, my book was Beyond Pascagoula, and I gave some emphasis to the sound and all the information I could collect on that because it wasn't ever explained. I wrote Beyond Reasonable Doubt with Philip Mantle, and we had a huge amount of research and information and enough material that should have convinced people, that would convince a jury, enough circumstantial evidence that something happened here.
Do you have a website?
IrenaScott.com.
Great, fantastic. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And that was an interview with Dr. Irena Scott about her book, Pascagoula, The Ultimate Close UFO Encounter. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. If you want to try out the extended episodes, you can get a 7-day free trial. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.